like to purchase a CD copy of Humankind by phone, please call 1-800-5-LISTEN, and our web address is humanmedia.org.
This segment, The Illumination of Rumi with Michael Green, is Humankind Program number 18.
Here is David Find.
Humankind is produced in association with WGBH Boston and supported by the Humankind Program Fund. Additional funding for this series has been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Institutes of Health, the Annie E. Casey Foundation, and the Park Foundation.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 23rd Annual Clinton Division Street Fair Saturday, July 25th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. with an after-party on Clinton Street from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. The community parade, Metamorphosis, will start at 10:45 a.m. There will also be artisan, craft, and community booths, sidewalk sales, live music, food, and more. Again, that's the 23rd Annual Clinton Division Street Fair, Saturday, July 25th, from 10 to 5 p.m., with an after-party on Clinton Street going until 9 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Andy Warhol looks a scream, hang him on the wall. Andy Warhol's silver screen can't tell him apart at all.
My name is Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week are Nicole Nathan, Deputy Director and Curator of Collections at the Museum of Contemporary Craft, and Namita Gupta-Wiggers, an independent curator and writer. And they're here to talk about State of Oregon Craft, which runs through August 15th at the Museum of Contemporary Craft. Thanks very much for coming into KBOO.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is a kind of a broad show. What's the idea as you get in there? It seems like it covers all of Oregon and it covers very different types of object. What's the unifying idea?
One of the unifying ideas we thought about, there are different themes which seem to come out through our conversations that we had in preparation for the exhibition. They really centered around how place informs making, the process, materials, how the community really ties into that, as well as skill sharing. Those were some of the things that really came up as we were talking about this and planning for it and make a difference in what craft is throughout the state. So we wanted to go out all over the state and get a good representation of what's happening, not just focus on I-5 corridor or Portland or the metro area, but get a good flavor of what was happening across the state, and then also taking into account those types of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And we really also wanted to make sure that it wasn't a biennial. It's not a survey in a sense of taking a core sample of what's happening. We wanted to take a look at what's going on around the state, talk to people, use that research to determine what we put into the museum, and then use that to be able to help people understand more broadly, in a different way, the meta questions of what's happening in craft and the different things that are going on with craft through those different themes that Nicole mentioned.
Nicole, if, say, a tourist from Florida walked in and spent an hour and a half, what kind of impression do you think they would get of craft in Oregon?
I believe they would notice that it is varied. It is a lot of different ways of making that people use throughout their lives. It's really accessible for people. It's part of everyday life for some participants, but that you can go to a number of locations throughout the state and craft is part of the fabric of either that community or the way that people live in a given portion of the state. So I think that's one of the things they would certainly realize. And there's just a variety and breadth of ways of making. It's everything from fine art jewelry that Anya Kavarkas is making in Eugene to very from the earth based ceramics at the East Creek Onagama Kiln. So it runs the gamut of somewhat DIY to what we call fine art jewelry or craft, and even art with a capital A.
Yeah. Namita, you come in and there's this display of stuff made by Mudshark, and they're a clay studio, but they're very much industrial. I mean, I've been in there. They're making thousands of units. They're it's all slip cast, isn't it?
It is.
A growler, or you make a teapot in a mold with liquid clay, and then they'll make a lot of them, and they finish them by hand. Are you focusing there on the process, or is it the design? Why are they there?
It's a number of things. First, it's ceramics. It's a ceramic process. The second thing is, it's a company that's started by two people who really wanted to find a way to support the ceramics field and had specialized skills. There are very, very, very few people in this country who know how to produce molds and to make things in the kind of unlimited production, factory-oriented way that Mudshark is doing.
Mm-hmm.
With that, it broadens the idea of what craft is if we recognize production and the production of multiples as part of craft process. In the last 15 to 20 years, craft has started to become understood to be the singular object, the one of a kind, a lot like art. And it is that which people like Ryan LaBarre and Eric Franklin in the exhibition clearly demonstrate. But in addition to that, craft is also about multiples and the things like tableware that go on to into everyday service, or the production processes derived from the factory. But in our country right now, finding factory production is harder at the scale that Mudshark is doing. So we really wanted to celebrate the way that they are bringing craft processes into industrial production and really marrying design and craft.
Mm-hmm. And they also, they're very automated in the sense that they have this whole back-end system that measures every unit of work that every person does. Your swipe cards and everything is tracked, and it's very, very efficient. So where are you allowed to have that in the craft world now?
I think it's always been there. I think that... Oh, that's a funny question.
That's a great question.
I love it. I would say that now, acknowledging technology and work process and labor in a different sort of way is definitely part of the craft world. I think maybe 20, 30 years ago, you would have wanted to deny all of those processes and really just focused on the hand finishing. But things have shifted, and we have a new generation that has a much broader understanding of what constitutes making. And with that, it opens up a space for you to make everything by hand or bring in industrial processes and do everything in between. So it's a different definition.
And things have maybe all shifted in the direction of robotics, because a lot of stuff is now made by robots. Maybe they're just taking part of the automation, but they're still got the craft vibe going on.
Well, ironically, in certain fields, the automation that you're describing just isn't possible. I think it's more that it's been shipped overseas. You know, the production of tableware and ceramics is just not happening in the United States in the way that it may have in certain areas at one point. So what Brett and Chris are doing with Mudshark is really reminding us that there are certain things that really are made by hand. You just don't see who's making them, and they're being made by other people's hands in other parts of the world, and not necessarily by robotics, although technology certainly is going that way in some regards.
Mm-hmm. Nicole, one of the pieces that really struck me was Eric Franklin's work. He makes skulls and skeletons out of glass. They're tubular glass, but not regular. And inside the glass is neon gas, which is charged and lit up. So just like a neon sign, but not as bright. They're extraordinary objects. Who is this guy? And why is he doing this?
Eric Franklin is an artist working with glass over the last 15 years. That's what he focused on, as well as sculpture in his undergraduate. He has a really amazing following on social media. So while he may not be known necessarily as much around the Portland area or even regionally, he has a lot of pull and a lot of breadth in terms of that larger community. He's represented by Laura Russo, has been for a number of years, and participates in a lot of glass exhibitions nationally and the world. But Eric is really an amazing example of what craft can be and what it can become. That, yes, we think of glass as craft, but this is a very different application of glass. The glass is more like Pyrex. That's the type of glass that it is, so it's hard to work with. It's not typically like the blown glass that we're more familiar with from Dale Chihuly or Northwest.
Mm-hmm. Is it? How's Pyrex different?
It's more fragile. Eric uses a torch to manipulate it, and then it goes into the kiln, and then he fills it with the neon. So it's very process-oriented. It has a lot of steps which go into it, and it's very meticulous and very specialized. So I think what's really great about Eric's work is that it really shows that knowledge and that dedication and that process which goes into it, which you don't see until you get to the final product. And really talking about what kinds of things you have to, you know, be knowledgeable about to be able to make something like this, because you also don't see pieces like that.
Mm-hmm. What pushes him over the line into the art gallery world? Because people who make skulls, you know, usually end up in Saturday Market mm-hmm. selling rings and T-shirts and designing album covers. What is it about what he's done that makes it art gallery stuff?
Well, I think it's because he has such a different approach to it. It's not, he's viewing these as a way he can illustrate how the body works, how the fragility of the body can be combined with a material like glass, which also is fragile, but also has a lot of strength to it. And, you know, it's this combination of different kinds of materials. It's just a lot of things.
Well, and I mean, the human figure is something that has stood the test of time. The focus on the figure in some way, shape, or form in art is never really going to go away. And mm-hmm. his approach to the figure is really using these very specialized materials, something that is more commonly understood through signage or, Pyrex dishes and things like that. But Eric is taking that and applying it to understanding, as Nicole was saying, systems and the body and the physical form in a different way. His work has been collected by some pretty prominent art collectors outside of the state. And we should mention that the piece that's in the museum was a commission.
Which piece?
The large full-size skeleton.
Right. There's two skulls and then there's a big skeleton.
And mm-hmm. a big skeleton. And the big skeleton really was his breakthrough piece. And the Museum of Contemporary Craft has a longstanding tradition of celebrating artists at the moment that they have this shift in their own work. People should know that that piece is a breakthrough piece for Eric. It was actually completed during the time Eric worked for the museum as our preparator.
Oh, and who owns the piece?
It is in a private collection right now. It's available. People are trying to find a new home for it. That particular piece he completed over a period of 2 years while helping move the museum from Corbett to its present location. And that piece, that commission, it's a great example of how patronage can work, particularly in Oregon, where somebody gave him enough funds that he could focus 2 years of his personal work just on developing that piece, and it taught him things that he never would have known, and his career skyrocketed from there in terms of his work. So it's a great Oregon story in many ways.
Mm-hmm. It'd be nice to see it in the dark.
Yes.
We tried to make it as dark as we could, but You can't do that totally. Yeah. It's a stunning piece. And like Namita was saying, it's really this point in time where he was able to teach himself all these different ways of making where that he would take and use in the skulls that you see. You know, those are much more recent pieces. And now that's another way where he can continue to grow his skills and make pieces from there that really help to build on that process.
Mm-hmm. A company there, Hamley & Co., they make saddles, mm-hmm. and anyone who's been to the Pendleton Roundup's probably seen their work. They make elaborate but working saddles. Is that right? They're not just for show.
Definitely.
Or trophy.
No, they were mostly made for working cowboys, and that's still the majority of who they make for. Working ranchers, cowboys, and people who need these on an everyday basis. They're a tool which their customers need to do their jobs. They're not just a trophy piece or something for commemoration or something mm-hmm. like that. They're an everyday working tool.
Yeah. So some of the materials are wood, rawhide, nails, leather, obviously, nickel. Was it nickel or mm-hmm. silver? One in there is called the Wade saddle.
There are two different saddles in there. There's the Wade saddle, which you're talking about. That's a newer piece. And they're all made for individuals. And this particular one, while it is probably more of a commemorative saddle, it's used. And it's the Wade saddle is a type of saddle that has become known and popular and something that people want probably over the last 80 to 100 years.
Oh, it's a style? Wade means?
A Wade saddle okay. is a style of yeah. saddle. The other one is also a particular style.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, they're making tools. They're making tools for use. It's so popular right now to talk about heritage brands, and it's a really popular thing to put, you know, the year that your company was founded out there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Hamley's was founded in what was it?
1883 in the United States, and historically came from Cornwall, England, and had been saddle makers for centuries. So this is really a long-standing tradition and way of making.
Mm-hmm.
So it brings into the conversation and in our mind this idea of what really constitutes longevity and a heritage brand, and the idea that when you're making something beautiful and you're making it to last. And that's sort of the value that Hamley's brings into the conversation by being in this exhibition. In addition to that, there's just... It's unusual to include a saddle maker in an exhibition about craft. We really wanted to bring them in because they give us a chance to talk about what's regionally specific to Oregon. Ranching is a large industry here. It's a big part of everyday life for much of the state, and we wanted mm-hmm. to be sure to honor really outstanding craftspeople related to that field.
Did you look at other industries like fishing or logging? Do they have objects that you would have taken into your museum?
We could have considered fishing lures. There's a whole craft to making those. And in fact, one of the students in the MFA in Applied Craft and Design program in the last year or two did a whole project based on the history of fishing lures. That certainly could have been something we brought in. In terms of the logging industry, I mean, the tricky thing is the kind of wood that we have in Oregon is not the kind of wood that is best for making long-standing furniture and things mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah.
So it's just a different kind of wood. So the traditions would have been very, very different to bring in that regard.
Yeah. It's such a broad show about craft. And where do you draw the line? Do you go for chainsaw art? Do you go for burl coffee tables? What did you look at and then have to reject?
When we were talking about this, we knew we couldn't show everything. And that mm-hmm. was the whole point, is that our space doesn't lend itself to that. And it just wasn't a helpful way for us to be able to think about craft, because that's just so broad and it has so many iterations that could come out of that. This was a somewhat deep dive into the few different things that we saw that were coming up in the last 10 years or so, or things that had changed, and that things that were really, or some of the themes that don't change over time. So for instance, like community, you know, East Creek Onagama Kiln is all about community. It's been around since the early 80s, and it continues to bring in new people every time they do a firing. So in terms of what you draw the line at, I think that that certainly is a question that we grappled with, definitely.
I mean, is it like a high craft and a low craft, and you're just trying to avoid the low?
You know, I don't think that, that as an institution we've really made those high-low hierarchical distinctions. At least, you know, that's what we've been working against in many ways. So in terms of research process, I mean, there are lots of times we would meet and start dividing up. At the beginning point, we made these huge sheets where we divided up the kinds of things that could be there. And then it sometimes it can be about a particular approach to materials. Sometimes the lists might have been about specific artists that we thought we wanted to include, or how would we get at some of these changes that Nicole was talking about, like the introduction of Mud Shark and other kinds of processes and so forth. And as you go through the year and a half almost of research, a little bit more than that even, each of those meetings where we would have these lists, each of us would then go off and delve a little more deeply to figure out what would be the exemplary element to include the exhibition to address particular shifts and changes and specific kinds of work that are going on. We didn't want it to be a biennial. We didn't want it to be a survey. Mm-hmm. We wanted to be something where we were analyzing what's been happening and share that analysis really through the exhibition itself. I could describe all of the research meetings in detail,
please.
But it's really boring. think it's really
so
fun.
It's, but, yeah. you use the C word quite a lot. Community.
We were wondering which one you meant.
Which C word are you talking about?
The kiln thing is... Tell us about the kiln briefly. It brings people together, right?
It does. It was really an amazing experience.
What's it called?
The East Creek Onagama Kiln is based outside Willamina, which is a logging town, really.
Where
based.
Is that?
It is between McMinnville and Lincoln City, and it's in the Coast Range mountains. And it is a logging town, has been centered around wood for probably as long as it's been in existence. And it was developed and put together as an educational resource by Frank Boyden, Tom Coleman, and Nils Liu, who taught at Linfield for years until his death and taught ceramics. And so it was really this exploration of bringing together the people who wanted to make and finding this new kind of kiln, new to Oregonians, new to the West Coast, and new to the United States, but based on a very old Korean and Japanese type of kiln. So,
what do you get out of the kiln at the end?
You get some really amazing, all different kinds of pieces. It's a huge, actually physically huge kiln, and you get, you know, whatever goes into it can be everything from, we have very tiny miniatures all the way up to pieces that were, you know, sometimes 2 by a couple feet by a couple feet. Nothing is super huge, but those are kind of the dimensions.
And this particular kiln it's a wood-fired kiln. And so it's built into the hill, and then the chimney comes out of the hill. And so you actually have to climb into it in order to stack the pieces, and you have to stoke it for a period of several days around the clock. So it's really about the fire and the ash creating sort of there's a place in the front, and then there's two vents on the sides. And you stoke the front, and then you drop pieces of wood into the side vents literally around the clock. And everyone from high school students, high school students to professional potters to academic instructors are involved in this process. Everyone is equal in terms of running the whole process. And what happens is that flame basically goes through, and the ash then gets heated up, and as the ash starts to melt, it creates the glaze and the effects. And as you unload the kiln, what we could really see is where the fire had gone through. And one of the artists explained to us that a great description is, if you imagine the way that water goes through in a river and there's a rock that's in the way, and the way the water moves around the rock, that's the way that the fire and smoke is moving around all of the pieces. So you really see the effects of the flame going through on each of the individual mm-hmm. pieces. It's most Anagama kilns of this kind are very, very personal, and they take so much work, so much cutting of the wood and stoking and cleaning and et cetera, that it's very rare actually to find this kind of one that is designed for everyone from novices to experts to actually fire together. So it's a really incredibly unique experience.
So they come together and, you know, it must take a few days, right, for everything to cool down and everything. Mm-hmm. And what do? They take it out.
Yes. So,
and then what?
So if you watch the videos that were done, basically the video that's in the museum, it shows the process of unloading. So it takes about a week for it all to cool down. And actually, even the pieces that were way in the back were still slightly warm to touch. That's how hot the fire mm-hmm. gets. And as they unload it, it's a beautiful process. Actually, everybody passes each piece down from person to person who's participated, and then they lay them all out on boards. And so every single piece gets looked at and investigated and talked about and touched and handled by every single person who's participated.
You know what it reminded me of? I saw something about barbecue in Portland, and how, these guys are great because they stoke their fire for like 3 days, and, you know, their meat cooks for 2 days. And you're from Texas, right?
Yes.
You probably know all about this, but it feels like people are importing these incredibly labor-intensive things because they want to feel some kind of connection. Obviously, they want something that tastes different, but they love spending days doing something.
Well, it is. It's a real social experiment, and it's a time for people to come together, not only around the kiln, but there were life events that were happening. There was an impromptu baby shower when we were there to stoke the kiln at night during our first visit there. One of the kiln masters who've been there since the early 2000s, their daughter was having a baby. And so we had a shower, and everybody shares food, and you make communal meals, and, you know, high school kids talk to academics, and everybody has the same footing. And it really is this time to come together and talk about, what did you do for this? What kind of process did you take? What do you think is going to come out? Because you don't know what the pieces will look like. You aren't able to anticipate that. You can have a general idea. You might be able to predict how the materials will react, but it's not clear, because at any given time, the fire could be not hot enough. It could get too hot. The glaze could react, or the clay could react one certain way. So it's very interesting, because it is kind of an experiment every time, but it's still this great coming together of people, and all these different people who have this one purpose at that given time, but their lives are intertwined. It's a real milestone.
And in addition to that, it's the first kiln of its kind to have been built in Oregon. So there are some dozen or so Anagama and Noborigama kilns that are in Oregon and in Washington and in this area. We have a very, very large number. I mean, it's a logical thing given the amount of wood as a resource. It's an easy thing to use or to have access to be able to do this. But this kiln was the very first one of its kind. And Ruri, her kiln, for example, was developed based on her experiences with the East Creek Anagama kiln. And there's a number of them that have that you'll find around the state. So it's the reason that we focused on this kiln in particular, given that there are so many, is because it has been this really important catalyst for understanding and experimenting with wood-fired kilns, and specifically Japanese and Korean-style kilns in this part of the country.
Nicole, there are programs, things people come and see and hear around the exhibition. What have you got?
On July 28th, which is a Tuesday, at the museum from 6:30 to 8 p.m., we will have a moderated panel discussion. Namita and I will be moderating participants from East Creek Onagama. We'll have some of the people who have been involved with it for years, some new people, and we'll also have Sarah Seastream, a basket maker, and she will be bringing members of her tribal advisory group called Lifeways. That's with the Grand Ronde. 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the museum. It's free with admission. We'd love to see you there.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week were Nicole Nathan, the Deputy Director and Curator of Collections at the Museum of Contemporary Craft, and Namita Gupta-Wiggers, an independent curator and writer. Together they worked on a show called State of Oregon Craft, which runs through August the 15th at the Museum of Contemporary Craft at 8th and Davis in the North Park blocks. Thanks so much for coming into KBOO.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Andy Warhol looks a scream, hang him on the wall. Andy Warhol's silver screen can't tell him apart at all.
Muy buenas tardes, esto es Tania Gómez Daza para KBOO News. A continuación, un corte informativo en español para el día 14 de julio de 2014. Estados Unidos e Irán y otras seis potencias internacionales han llegado a un acuerdo histórico que frena el acceso de los iraníes a la bomba atómica a cambio de levantar sanciones impuestas por el Occidente, mismas que volverían en caso de que Irán incumpla con este convenio. Este martes en Viena se informó que este pacto pone fin a 35 años de enfrentamientos entre Washington y Teherán y que además podría frenar la violencia extremista y la guerra en esta región. La NASA celebra que ha alcanzado su mayor acercamiento al planeta Plutón, cerrando así el reconocimiento inicial del sistema solar. New Horizons es el nombre de esta nave espacial que está realizando esta expedición y que estará enviando algunas imágenes de este planeta hasta ahora poco estudiado. La Comisión Nacional de Seguridad de México informó que en los primeros minutos del domingo, el ex líder del cártel de Sinaloa, el Chapo Guzmán, se fugó del penal de máxima seguridad del altiplano. El aviso a militares demoró hasta 3 horas y media y hoy hay una recompensa de 60 millones de pesos a quien informe de su paradero. La Agencia de Drogas estadounidense, DEA, ya había avisado en 2014 a las autoridades mexicanas de